Happy Fed Day, everybody.
I want to start with a plain English summary of how the economy is doing, what my colleagues and I at the Federal Reserve are trying to do, and why.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 22nd day of March. Good, as always, to have you along. All right, so look, to be clear, that piece of audio up in the open that we just played was from one of Jay Powell's very first press conferences, not today's. But I played it because the Fed chair today had a very fine public messaging line to walk. There was, of course, and is, the whole banking situation.
I guess our view is that the banking system is sound and it's resilient. It's got strong capital and liquidity.
There was some calming of the waters going on, right?
We took powerful actions with Treasury and the FDIC, which demonstrate that all depositors' savings are safe and that the banking system is safe.
And there was and is this.
The process of getting inflation back down to 2% has a long way to go and is likely to be bumpy.
And this is where things get tricky, because you got a banking situation on one hand and inflation on the other, and neither of those exists in a vacuum. So here are the relevant parts of a single, long-ish Powell answer, chopped up just a little bit, about how those two things are kind of working together.
So, you know, we've just come from an FOMC meeting.
That's the Federal Open Market Committee, which sets rates and which wrapped up its meeting right before Powell started taking questions.
And, you know, the people who write the minutes will be very carefully counting.
The minutes of this meeting are coming out in 3 weeks.
But I'll tell you what I heard. What I heard was a significant number of people saying that they anticipated there would be some tightening of credit conditions, and that would really have the same effects as our policies do.
That's the nut graph right there, the meat of this story. The pullback in lending that we've been seeing since SVB went under is going to do the same thing as a Fed rate hike. And it's happening in real time.
Remember, this is 12 days ago. You know, we're trying to assess something that just is so recent. And it's people, you know, it's very difficult. There's so much uncertainty.
And that effectively changed the Fed's mind on how much to raise rates.
In a way, the data in the first part, the first 5 weeks of the intermediate period, pointed to stronger inflation and a stronger labor market. So that pointed to higher rates.
Except,
and then this latter part, kind of the possibility of credit conditions tightening really offset that effectively.
Which is how we got to a quarter of a percentage point increase in the federal funds rate today, the ninth in a year, by the way. A little bit more from Jay Powell coming up later on. Can never get enough of Jay Powell. On Wall Street today, it was the classic, oh yeah, we like what Powell's saying. Oh wait, no, we don't dance that traders do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As a whole lot more people have probably discovered the past 10 days, 2 weeks, interest rates aren't the Federal Reserve's only job. It's also a banking regulator. And one way the Fed exercises that supervision is with what have come to be called stress tests, basically gaming out how banks would handle some given set of economic adversities and then whether they would be okay or wind up in deep trouble. But those stress tests only apply to a handful of the very biggest banks. And after Congress rolled back parts of the Dodd-Frank law, they didn't apply to Silicon Valley Bank at all. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman spent some time talking to people about what stress tests can and cannot do and how that might change now.
Stress tests have been around for a while. Financial firms have used them to make sure their bond holdings can weather big, unexpected economic storms, says Joe Mason at Louisiana State University.
Something like the U.S. Great Depression, extreme unemployment, extreme declines in U.S. economic growth.
After the 2008 financial crisis, the Dodd-Frank law mandated stress testing for banks with $50 billion or more in assets. Then in 2018, Washington raised the threshold to $250 billion. Eric Talley at Columbia Law School says Silicon Valley Bank lobbied for the change and...
they had been able to dodge the stress testing and enhanced scrutiny that larger banks had to withstand.
With 2020 hindsight, says Talley,
I think there's an argument that had Silicon Valley Bank gone through these stress tests, they would have had more capital to deal with the situation that they ended up encountering.
It's possible Congress will lower the stress test threshold in response to the current crisis. But Mason says even so,
the stress test and the capital modeling have their limitations.
For example, Mason says the Fed's most recent stress tests didn't consider an adverse scenario that included what was actually happening, sharply rising interest rates and how they could hurt some banks' balance sheets.
If that stress test is not very stressful, you're not going to expect to get a very good read on the condition of the bank or how it's supposed to survive a shock to the economy.
Mason says even if more mid-sized banks were subject to stress testing,
the problem with the Fed's scenarios is that they didn't start with the fact that rates are already high. They were assuming zero rates. We don't have that world, unfortunately.
Now, the Fed's stress testing is designed primarily to reveal what would happen if the economy went into recession. The Fed cut interest rates and banks had to write off big loan losses, says Ken Leon at CFRA Research. But the situation now with interest rates high is all about
liquidity risk and deposits and duration risk. And this really falls under the Fed's bank supervision mandate.
Meaning the Fed's other regulatory powers could be brought to bear to safeguard the banking system. Leon says what's needed now,
more examiners for the Fed, probably a bigger budget so that you can even regulate very closely the smaller banks. Supervision is really going to be the solution to make sure this doesn't happen again.
The Fed's out in the field right now with its 2023 stress tests on the country's biggest banks. It's unclear if they'll take more account of interest rate risk and liquidity challenges this time around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As Chair Powell said today, and as we have said on this program, I cannot tell you how many times, for all of the Fed's interest rate increases, the American labor market is still hot. Unemployment is still low, and there are still a whole lot of job openings, even with all the tech layoffs that we keep seeing. So given all that, Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports now on who's hiring.
Now is either a terrible time or a great time to be looking for a job, depending on who you are and what you want to do. Work in tech or media, like me, it's kind of a stressful time. But outside of those industries, there are still a lot of options. Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says that's especially true in leisure and hospitality.
Pretty much every month, leisure and hospitality jobs have been chipping away at the shortfall.
Many of the industries doing the most hiring right now, she says, are the ones that were hit hardest during the pandemic.
We also saw job increases in the education and health services sector and in retail services.
As you may have surmised, a lot of these are jobs that don't pay all that well. But Layla O'Kane at the labor market analytics company Lightcast says people are taking them, especially at restaurants, stores, and hotels. One sign of that?
Things like sign-on bonuses and training, which were being heavily offered in those fields earlier last year, are down into the new year.
There are other areas, though, where labor shortages persist. Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter says those include home health care, child care, and nursing.
The number one job category on ZipRecruiter right now is nursing, with over 1 million active online job postings, which is really incredible.
Restaurants and software jobs are second and third, she says, with 500,000 postings each. And there's also a lot of hiring starting to happen in government again.
The government has lagged behind the private sector in recovering from the pandemic, but finally seems to be making headway now. And that is likely because wage growth is slowing elsewhere in the private sector.
So those lower paying government jobs, she says, are now getting a bit more competitive. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. The Fed does what it does, banks do what they do, and businesses gotta keep on plugging away. Bed Bath & Beyond is trying, again, to stay out of bankruptcy protection and get back to retailing. Its latest move is to ask shareholders to approve a reverse stock split. That is a strategy you don't often see, so we asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to explain.
Let's start this with a super quick lesson on good old-fashioned stock splits, not the reverse kind. A company decides its stock price is too high and wants to make it more affordable, so it divides its shares, say, in half. That means there are double the number of shares available for half the price.
And then a reverse stock split is literally just the reverse of all of that.
Philip Bond is a finance professor at the University of Washington. He says a company might consider a reverse split when the price of shares drops too low. So the company, say, doubles the price of its stock by cutting them in half. Bond says regular stock splits are all about optics. I am affordable, accessible, buy me. A reverse stock split can make a company appear more valuable, but
there are a few more sort of real reasons unrelated to market psychology why you might want to do a reverse stock split.
The NASDAQ, where Bed Bath & Beyond is traded, it will move to delist companies that fall under $1 for 30 consecutive trading days. BB&B slipped under $1 on Monday. It's why Alice Bonomé, a professor of finance at the University of Arizona, says a reverse stock split sends a message.
That the company is not confident enough that the stock will rise on its own. They have to take more extreme measures.
This move doesn't always spell doom, but Morningstar analyst Jamie Katz says BB&B is on a path of last resort.
On top of like being in a fundamentally difficult place in retailing, your biggest exposure is the housing market.
It's a home goods store, and the housing market has slowed with rising interest rates. She says it's likely the company will eventually face Bed Bath and bankruptcy. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And I was like, what?
Sounds like the right response to the SVB implosion, if you ask me. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today on Fed data. Dow Industrial slipped 530 points, about 1.6%, closed at 32,030, did the blue chips. NASDAQ down 190 points, also 1.6%, 11,669. S&P 500 dropped 65 points. Oh, look, 1.6%, 39.36. A lot of dancing around, though, as I said before that. Kristen Schwab was just telling us about Bed Bath & Beyond's reverse stock split attempt. Its stock slipped 2.5% today. Shareholders were excited for the video game retailer GameStop. Its stock jumped. GameStop. Hello, Kai. Its stock jumped 35% after the company posted its first quarterly profit in 2 years. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.45%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Jay Powell wasn't the only one answering questions in Washington today. The CEO of Moderna was up on Capitol Hill testifying in front of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, members of which were none too happy about the company's recent announcement that it's going to start charging something like $130 a dose for its COVID vaccine after the national health emergency ends in May. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on that one.
Some members of Congress are having some severe sticker shock. In today's hearing, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders highlighted billions the U.S. government spent to help develop and roll out Moderna's extremely profitable mRNA COVID-19 vaccine.
This vaccine would not exist without NIH's partnership and expertise and the substantial investment of the taxpayers of this country.
The $130 refers to the list price of the vaccine, which is something of a starting point for negotiations, says Richard Hughes, a partner at the law firm Epstein Becker Green. He was an executive at Moderna up until about a year ago.
No American who is not a health insurance company is going to see a $130 price tag for this vaccine.
He says government or private insurance will still cover the cost for most people. And
the government will continue to receive a very low price. And companies do negotiate discounts with payers.
Even so, when insurers pay more, so do their customers. And so do taxpayer-funded programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. Plus, says Andrea Dukas, a senior program officer with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation,
there's still about 30 million people who don't have health insurance. And for those folks, they would be essentially either, unless there's a patient assistance program, expected to pay out of pocket.
Moderna's CEO said today the company would ensure that anyone who wants a vaccine will be able to get one without cost being a barrier. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Early on in the pandemic, well before those vaccines Kimberly was talking about, there were a couple of big government loan programs meant to help small businesses make it through. There was the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP loans that we've talked about, forgiven almost entirely and by design. There was also the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, EIDL is what it's called. 30-year loans with a fixed rate of 3.75%, which businesses do have to repay. The Small Business Administration, though, let those businesses defer repayment for up to 2.5 years, which means those payments are starting to come due. So Marketplace's Justin Ho talked to a couple of businesses that took out those EIDL loans, starting at a manufacturing company right near downtown San Diego.
The company is called Vet Powered because it has a workforce of military veterans. It manufactures custom metal components for the private sector and the Defense Department. Tom Brewer, a programmer and machinist, works with a milling machine.
Right here, we're running a part to test the alignment.
The milling machine shears slices off an aluminum block, little by little, until it becomes the hand of a robotic arm. Hernan Luisi Prado is VetPowered CEO.
You can make almost any product that you like on this machine. What it does is it takes a block of material, and then it removes all the excess material, almost like Michelangelo, right? The parts in there, you just have to chip away the unneeded parts.
And VetPowered has the machine thanks to an EIDL loan. And Luisi Prado says it's not the only one. There's an automatic saw.
We actually purchased that machine and these two as well. And one of these two machines with the EIDL on me.
VetPowered was planning to build this facility before the pandemic. When COVID hit, the EIDL money allowed Luisi Prado to go ahead with the expansion and keep his staff employed at a time when lending had dried up completely.
There was nothing in sight. Banks didn't want to lend. You didn't have the reserves. It was a really, really hard time. And had it not been for the EIDL loans, I think we would have been doomed.
Instead, after a year and a half, VetPowered had paid back its EIDL loan, at which point Luisi Prado turned around and took out an even bigger commercial loan.
What we really needed was to get more equipment, and we need to have people on site to train on that equipment.
The Small Business Administration made about 4 million EIDL loans, and a lot of them are still outstanding.
You know, when you look at debt, it's important to look through the lens of good debt versus bad debt. And to me, this is good debt.
That's Madeline Reeves. She runs a marketing and consulting firm called Fearless Foundry near Seattle. Reeves says her business grew during the pandemic, and the loan helped her expand her staff. She'll have to start making payments this year, but she says she's not paying much in interest compared to the kind of loans she could get today.
You know, I see things out there with terms that are more like 20% over 5 years or things like that. And so for me, you know, it's built into our budget and, you know, we have the capacity to pay it off over time.
But some businesses are struggling to find that capacity. Daniel Jacobs owns a restaurant in Milwaukee called Dan Dan. He's been paying back his loan since December to the tune of almost $4,000 a month.
I mean, that's a whole employee. That's a whole employee's month salary.
And so in order to afford the payments, Jacobs decided to open the restaurant one more day a week. So it's now open every day.
You know, we should be hiring an extra person to kind of help out with that. Instead, we're going to have to stretch it out and just, you know, do with what we have because we can't afford that extra person right now.
Jacobs says he's confident he'll be able to keep making the payments. But a lot of other businesses might not be, says Matt Hetrick, who runs the accounting firm Harmony Group.
Businesses that really haven't recovered the entirety of their business
levels from pre-pandemic are now commencing payments on loans that they took to get through a really, really uncertain time.
Hedrick says some businesses may have used the money to expand too quickly, for instance.
I think the people who took it saw money in their bank and made decisions to run their businesses in ways that weren't necessarily as profit driven or as careful as they otherwise would have are now in trouble.
As a result, Hedrick says businesses could end up defaulting on their loans this year, and some might go out of business entirely. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We've been talking to Christina Stemble for 3 years now, give or take. She's the CEO of a direct-to-consumer flower company called Farm Girl Flowers that she started 13 years ago with $49,000 of her own money. Until 2 weeks ago, she kept most of her company's money at Silicon Valley Bank, which brings us to this scene. Christina Stemble in a Zoom meeting the Friday before last.
And I get a text message from my chief of staff. And she says, have you heard about Silicon Valley Bank? They've been seized. And I was like, what? I immediately, texted our director of accounting. She tried to put some wires through, some transfers through to our secondary bank. We were like, well, maybe they'll miraculously make it through. They did not. And also the people that I had been talking to, it was like, do you have a secondary bank? I'm like, yes, I do. First Republic. And they were like, oh, get your money out immediately from there because they're the next one. And so I started researching that and I was like, oh, crap. I was sitting there at one point thinking, oh, I'm back to where I said I would never be again after COVID. I said, I'm never going to be in a position where I'm sitting on the couch crying my eyes out thinking I've just given over a decade of my life to something that I'm walking away with zero. First thing Monday morning, I woke up at 3 and I just started refreshing my computer on Silicon Valley Bank's webpage over and over and over again. And then I also went to First Republic in person as soon as they opened. So I was able to get enough that would cover some payrolls, which is great, and felt assured with that, cashier's check in my bag. And then Monday night, I sat on my couch and I wrote all of my learnings, which is what I try to do when I go through really, really crappy times like this. And, I had 3 main takeaways. We'll diversify more. We'll have more than 2 banks. We won't be able to get down. I keep hearing and reading that people are like, you should never have more than the FDIC insured amount. That's not possible when it's $250,000 to run a company. We have invoices from transportation companies that are bigger than that for like a week, So it's just not possible. But diversifying more. And then, also besides diversification, making sure that our money makes money too. And so I'm working on a plan to manage our money better. And then the third thing is to pay myself, which I think as women, we don't like to talk about. It makes us feel selfish to say that. It does for me. It's hard for me to say that, but I've never paid myself, a salary that's even come close to what I should be paying myself. I didn't pay myself for 5.5 years. And when I did, I paid myself $60,000 a year for years. To be in a position where several times now in the last couple of years, where external circumstances fully could force me to walk away with nothing is crazy to me. And so I think what I want to say, because I think probably so many other women feel the same way, is pay yourself fairly. So that way, if you are forced to walk away with nothing, you didn't walk away with nothing. You at least paid yourself for your time and your efforts along the way.
That was a great piece. Christina Stemble, the CEO, the founder of Farm Girl Flowers. The this final note on the way out today, one last item from Chair Powell. You know how a couple of weeks ago we were all, oh yeah, soft landing, that could definitely happen. And then SVB and Credit Suisse and all the rest happened, and we were all like, oh no, hard landing for sure. Well, Powell was asked today about the odds of whatever landing we've got that's coming being soft.
I do still think, though, that there's a pathway to that. I think that pathway still exists, and we're certainly trying to find it.
Okay, we're going not, of course, without your moment of economic context. We started with banks. We shall end with banks. Shares of First Republic, the other place that a lot of SVB customers had their money, including Christina Stembel, shares down another 15% today, 89% in the past month. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.